Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Against the soaring hope of democratic change in the Arab world, the region's status quo powers cling to sectarian divides. The Saudi intervention in Bahrain may buttress Saudi monarchy, but it's been cast as a hip check against Iran, Sunni versus Shia. The old conflicts are real. So are new aspirations. This hour on Point, new uprisings and old tensions in the Middle East. We'll ask if the waves of change in the Arab world will crash down in old battlegrounds. You can join the conversation. Is the Arab wave still about democracy versus dictatorship? What about the other old tensions behind, beneath? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me today from New York is Bernard Haykel, professor of Near East Studies at Princeton University. Professor Haykel, thank you very much for being with us today.
It's a pleasure.
And from Washington, Suzanne Maloney, senior fellow at the Brookings Institute, author of Iran's Long Reach. Suzanne Maloney, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
There's still so much going on, Bernard Haykel. I mean, in whether you look at Yemen or Syria or Bahrain itself, or, of course, Libya. But with the Saudis coming in with troops last week into Bahrain, things were cast in a new way. Some around the Saudis seemed eager to say, this is not so much about democracy. This is about our competition with Shiite Iran, and we've got to be here to keep Iran in check. What do you make of that? It's not always the formal public line, but you know that that's in the music behind that step last week, Bernard Haykel. Does that sound credible?
Well, you know, there are two ways in which these events have been depicted in the Middle East. And one is to say these are democratic movements, young people who want dignity and economic opportunity. And I think there's a great deal of truth in that. The other storyline about what's happening is that, and this comes from status quo powers, mm-hmm. is that, no, you know, the rules of physics still apply, and we still have interests, and there are still old rivalries. And the Saudis have adopted the latter position, namely to say that in Bahrain, where you have a majority of Shiites, if these people were to come to power democratically or otherwise, they would essentially become a vehicle for Iran, for the projection of Iranian power, and that's wholly unacceptable to the Saudis, which is why they, you know, supported the minority regime that rules in Bahrain and why they sent in troops.
Suzanne Maloney, the protesters in the streets are saying something quite different. I've seen many quoted in the streets of Bahrain saying, this is not a sectarian uprising. We just want a greater democracy here. Now, the numbers are what they are. You've got a Sunni monarchy and a Shiite majority population. But this is a kind of cloak or historical conflict that many in the pro-democracy movement have worked very hard to trying not to adopt, Suzanne.
Well, I think there are a couple of layers here at play with respect to Bahrain. The first is that there are legitimate grievances by the population that has felt ill-served by the slow-rolling process of reform that the Bahraini king has enacted over the course of the past decade. Those grievances have been expressed both peacefully over the years through protests and demonstrations and efforts to push for greater change. They've also been expressed violently at times in riots and periodic unrest. So I think no one was surprised to see that as turmoil began to move across the Middle East, that Bahrain was particularly susceptible to it because of these grievances. The other issue, of course, is that there is a history of tensions between Saudi Arabia and Iran, and they have at times played out specifically in Bahrain, which, of course, has some particular history for the Iranians in terms of claims to sovereignty by Tehran, both before and after the Islamic Revolution, and specific efforts to subvert both the Bahraini government and to promote violence against American interests in Bahrain in the early years after the 1979 revolution in Iran. So you've got, you know, multiple storylines, as Professor Haykel has suggested, playing out. The Saudis have chosen to view what's happening in Bahrain through what I think is an unfortunately antiquated narrative, an unfortunately antiquated perspective of what's happening across the region. And what they're likely to do is in fact, create the very scenario that they're hoping to forestall.
What do you mean by that? What do you imagine might play out as a result of the position they're taking and the troops they have there in Bahrain?
Well, I think, first of all, it's almost inevitable that you're going to see greater radicalization among the Bahraini Shia. You know, at the moment, we see at least some effort on the part of one of the key moderate groups to back down from the protests. But inevitably, over time, if we don't see more substantive movement toward real power sharing, toward a government which is actually representative in substance as opposed to just in name, you know, there's going to be continuing grievances. And that just opens the door for further Iranian influence and meddling and troublemaking. That's precisely what the Saudis have said they're intending to prevent. And I think, you know, the specter of an Arab military moving in to protect a minority government in the Gulf is one that worries not just, you know, outside observers, but others across the Gulf.
Is it clear, Bernard Haykel, beyond Bahrain and its special circumstances, but including Bahrain, is it so clear that the success of this so-called Arab wave, push for more democracy, would play out to Iran's advantage? After all, Iran has very publicly and brutally cracked down on its own democracy movement.
You make a very good point, Tom. I don't think it will, actually. I think that Iran stands to lose from this wave if a genuine democracy were to emerge in any country in the Arab world, especially in Egypt, precisely because it, you know, such a development would bring out the contradictions in the way the Iranian regime treats its own people. So, if you look at Iran, but for that matter, if you look at any of the regimes of the region, as well as the United States, there's a built-in contradiction in each of these countries' positions, namely that, you know, democracy is great for Iran in Bahrain, but it's awful in Syria, where they would like to maintain the status quo because the regime is an ally. It's you know, for the United States, it's fantastic to have a democracy in Bahrain, as well as the Saudis feel that way. About Libya. The Saudis and the Americans want a democracy in Libya, but they don't want it in Bahrain. So every country has this schizophrenic policy when it applies it across the board in this region. And on Yemen, there's no policy at all because there's a fear that Yemen would implode and turn into a Somalia.
Right there on the borders of Saudi Arabia with all of its al-Qaeda presence. What about, Suzanne, the U.S.? I mean, the U.S. is in Libya. It's not in Bahrain. It hasn't said to the Saudis, get your troops out of there. Let this movement roll ahead. Is the U.S. effectively adopting the same rationale? We can't have democracy in Bahrain because that would advantage Iran? Or is it just a status quo play? How do you see the Washington's policy here, Suzanne?
Again, I think there are some contradictory impulses. The fact that Secretary of Defense Bob Gates was out in Bahrain and spoke publicly about what the U.S. expected to see just before the Saudis moved the Gulf troops into the country, I think very clearly telegraphed that the administration as a whole was not trying to wink and nod and trying to offer kind of tacit support to the Saudi decision here. He said specifically that the world needed to see more than baby steps from the Bahraini regime in terms of real reforms. So I think clearly there are those within the U.S. government who recognize that, you know, the Bahrainis have to do more and they have to try harder and make a real effort to not simply prompt a dialogue, not simply initiate some sort of a conversation with the opposition, but actually create representative institutions and an electoral democracy, which is something that the king has said for a decade now he intends to do. Obviously, on the other hand, you know, the Fifth Fleet is stationed there. There are a lot of American interests there. The fear that Iran would, in fact, use a Shia-led Bahrain as a sort of launching point for greater subversion against our Arab allies in the Gulf is one that's very real here in Washington. There's no question about it. And I think, unfortunately, the sort of moderate and silent position that the administration has taken on Bahrain has given rise to this perception, one that I think is not entirely well-founded, but a perception that the United States is, in fact, supporting the Saudi military move into Bahrain. And that is a deeply problematic image, I think, for the administration to be putting out there at this point in time. Mm-hmm. Really, for the United States to appear on the side of those who are trying to repress democratic activists, that's not the narrative we want out there right now.
Bernard, do you agree? Does it look as though the United States is kind of at Bahrain, drawing a line in the sand and say, here we stop our praising sounds for democracy?
Absolutely. I mean, I do think that on Bahrain, and the Bahraini opposition is saying this very loud and clear now. But, you know, Saudi Arabia is a country that is extremely important to the United States and to the world because of the oil reserves in the proven oil reserves in the country. And that whole region has something like 60% of the world's proven oil reserves. So, you know, the United States already angered the Saudi leadership, which is very old and very entrenched and seeing the world in a particular way. The Saudis were very angered by the way the United States behaved in Egypt by not supporting a president, the late President Mubarak, unconditionally. So I think, you know, the Obama administration has had a very hard time trying to keep the Saudis on side. And in addition to oil and geostrategic interests, the United States needs Saudi Arabia also to pacify Yemen, because the Saudis are the only group or people and government who can speak to everybody in Yemen and who stand a chance of bringing some stability to this very unstable country.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about new uprisings and old tensions in the Middle East, dictators versus democracy, Sunni versus Shia, some still say, Saudi Arabia versus Iran, and the Arab wave trying to avoid the old traps. Not clear if it's succeeding. We're joined today by Bernard Haykel, professor of Near Eastern Studies at Princeton University, and Suzanne Maloney, senior fellow at the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institute, author of Iran's Long Reach. Lots of comments online already. Michael says, is Bahrain the latest proxy war between Iran and Saudi Arabia? A big fat no. Adiawa says, unless elections are held in Bahrain, we'll never know what democracy would bring to this tiny island. Says, it's an insult to Bahrain's Sunnis to assume that they don't also want democracy, good governance, and freedom. You can join us, 800-423-8255. Do either the Saudi monarchy or the religious dictatorship in Iran have anything important to say about democracy? Are the Saudi troops in Bahrain to stop Iran or to stop reform? 800-423-TALK. Let's hear from some of our listeners. Ahmed is calling from Burlington, Massachusetts. Ahmed, you're on the air. What do you see, sir?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
The thing I see is that as the speaker was saying that, you know, the Saudi have sent their troops just to stop the influence of Iran. I don't.
Ahmed, I'm afraid. Yeah, you're breaking up. What's that again? I'm sorry, Ahmed, you're breaking up. You're breaking up on us. Let's get one more right here. Khalil in Waltham, Massachusetts. Khalil, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm trying to say is that Bahrain and Saudi Arabia, they are the same dictatorship like Muammar Gaddafi and Hafez al-Assad, and the rest was gone by now. The United States should be very careful how they handle the situation. For every country, there is a special case. The people revolt for different reasons, and we should handle each one accordingly. Saudi Arabia, they have the worst dictatorship on earth. We should not just stand by them and ignore the people of Syria or Libya or other countries. We should treat all the revolts the same, or we're going to lose our credibility with the Syrians who's trying to do something now.
So, Khalil, if we're in Libya, should we also be involved in Bahrain, saying Saudis, get out?
Yes, I believe we should be involved in Bahrain, but in Bahrain and Saudi Arabia, we should do it peacefully. We should not let the Shia control Bahrain, since our interest in Bahrain. We should handle the situation peacefully, but we should let the people win at the end.
Khalil, I appreciate your call. Suzanne Maloney, what about U.S. options here? I mean, we see what the United States is doing. It's kind of tacking along. It's tolerating what's happened with the Saudis. I don't know what choices it has. What about policy options here for the U.S.? How else could we be playing this?
Well, I think one of the lessons of the events of the past few weeks in the Gulf is how deeply divided Washington and Riyadh are on the events that are playing out across the region.
You mean internally or between each other?
Between each other, mm-hmm. I think that there is, a real gulf between the two governments, both in the interpretation of what's happening and on how it ought to be handled. I don't think it's clear to the Saudis at this stage that these movements are really not within the control of the U.S. government to forestall. And I don't think it's clear the role that technology and simply the example of democratic activism is playing in mobilizing people across the region. I think also it's clear that, Washington's influence on Saudi policy has deteriorated, drastically.
Mm-hmm.
From my perspective, with Secretary Clinton having been out in the region at the time that the Saudis made this decision to send the troops into Bahrain, this was not the optic that the U.S. government wanted. They simply didn't want Secretary Clinton sitting in Cairo talking to activists and touring Tahrir Square while an allied Arab government moved its troops in to repress democracy protesters elsewhere. So the Saudis took this decision, I think, very much on their own. It reflects a deep level of resentment and anger, not only on the part of Saudi Arabia, but also on the part of the government of the United Arab Emirates, another important American ally and oil producer in the region.
Bernard, Tom Friedman is writing the New York Times today, sort of kind of a get real. I'm sure many democracy activists won't like it, but he's saying we've got tribes with flags here, and what you have across much of the Arab world is not like what you had in Tunisia and Egypt, old nations with a sense of unity. Friedman writing that Arab states now hosting rebellions, Yemen, Syria, Bahrain, Libya, are Iraq-like civil wars in waiting. It seems only a few minutes ago that there was a very strong feeling that didn't have to be true, that there was a modern, more globalized, younger generation that was looking to, get out of these traces of dictatorship and did not have to be prisoner of the old divisions. What happened to that, Bernard? Is it still there?
Well, I mean, it's true that, if you look at the demonstrators in Yemen, that they are, nationalistic. They've tried to not focus on the differences and the cleavages within the country. But you see, in some of the countries where you do have either tribal, ethnic, sectarian, or regional identity cleavages, the governments and the elites can play on these cleavages and can, as Suzanne, if I may, said earlier, mm-hmm. The Saudis can appeal or use these old divisions, but so can others, to basically maintain themselves in power and to play the good old game of divide and rule. If I may just add one more point, mm-hmm. which is that on what was being said just earlier, I speak to the Saudi leadership quite often, and there's a real sense of almost contempt for the United States, which in that they see the U.S. as having really messed up Iraq for them. They see the United States as being incapable of managing Afghanistan.
What does messed up Iraq mean? A Shia majority to take power?
Meaning a Shia majority, but there was also a civil war there, and mm-hmm. that, the order is still, the country's still very unstable for them. And so they think the United States is actually a force of instability rather than stability in the region, and they don't trust it as being able to bring solutions to the table. And so they very much want to do their own thing based on what they deem to be their core national interests. And they've done that in Bahrain, and I think they will do it also in Yemen and perhaps even in Syria and elsewhere. And this also points to the limits of American influence in the region and the fact that some of these dynamics that are taking place are regional and local, and there's a limit to what any outsiders can do to determine the outcome.
Suzanne, but the United States has been explicitly sort of pro-instability. I mean, George Bush came in saying, we want to have a new model in Iraq for democracy, and the implication was that would change up, shake up a lot of the Arab world. In its support for democracy, Hillary Clinton's made a lot of those sounds. That must mean instability, right? The status quo has not been democratic.
Well, the reality is we have no power to maintain the status quo, and frankly, neither do the Saudis, and that's what they're really missing about what's happening now. I fully understand their sense of angst over Iraq, but Iraq is effectively a done deal at this stage. We can't go back and rewrite history of 2003. And those resentments really need to be put aside, and they have to recognize that what's happening at this stage is not something the U.S. either instigated or had the ability to stand in the way of. You know, what was happening in Egypt was not a movement that I think had Washington tried to buttress Mubarak, it would have made a difference in the eventual outcome. It simply would have potentially produced a more radicalized outcome and a more violent one. I think one of the difficulties and one of the problems of U.S. policy in the region is we spend a lot of time trying to reassure our Gulf allies. We sell them billions of dollars of weapons. Mm-hmm. We look for every opportunity to cooperate with them. We ask things of them occasionally. Typically, we go to them to provide money in disaster relief and other areas where we might need some support. But we don't sort of force them to stand up and take responsibility for their own security. If the Saudis are unhappy with with the way things have turned out in Iraq, they really ought to be more present there. They ought to have established an embassy on day one. They ought to have been engaging with the Iraqi government in a much more substantive way. Instead, they simply look to us and they blame us for the outcome, and they really do nothing other than, you know, wish that somehow Washington could change the entire balance of power in the Middle East in their favor. That's not possible. I think we have real interests in common with the Saudi government. But one of the things we're going to have to do is, I think, do a little bit a better job of trying to get them to stand up and provide for their own security.
We're looking at,
which actually means liberalization and reform.
Which they have not shown a whole lot of willingness to do. There's talk of local elections, but the bigger wave the other way in Saudi royal circles. We're looking at new uprisings and old tensions in the Middle East. Dictators versus democracy, Sunni versus Shia, Saudi Arabia versus Iran. Let's go to Humboldt, Iowa, and Joe. Hi, Joe. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I always enjoy the show. I always learn a lot. I'd like to ask a question to your expert, maybe Bernard more than Susan. Does he see an analogy in the current situation, and especially I'm thinking in Libya, to Budapest in 1956 and maybe before Budapest to Warsaw? We didn't jump in. If you remember, we didn't go back the Hungarians, and we had Radio Free Europe encouraging them to revolt against their communist leaders, their dictators, and tens of thousands were killed. But then, over the next decades, the Hungarians took ownership of their own revolution, and I'm just wondering, in a broader question, is this unrest in the Middle East our new foreign policy paradigm? I mean, is this our new Cold War? Should we be settling in for a decade-long conflict?
Joe, let us pick it up right there, and I appreciate your call. I'll come to you, Suzanne, but first to Bernard Haeckel. I think people are wondering about this now. You know, what is the strength and maybe the kind of velocity of the Arab way we were talking about? Joe wonders if it, may end up subsumed for another 40 years, as it did after attempts to overthrow the Soviet Union's influence in Eastern Europe? Or is it burning too bright, too hot, too well-rooted for that, Bernard? What do you see coming?
Well, I mean, I think it's an excellent question. And, we always want to think in terms of analogies to make sense of the present. Mm-hmm. I think that there's a profound difference between the revolutions that happened in Central and Eastern Europe leading up to 1989 what we're seeing now. Largely because there was no question during the Cold War that countries like Poland or Hungary, once free of communism, would become democratic and would opt for the Western liberal democratic way. It's not clear to me that these countries in the Middle East, whether it's Libya or Yemen or even Egypt, that will necessarily be the outcome, that we will end up with a liberal democracy. There's a fear that Islamists may take over. In Libya, for instance, it's very interesting to see that al-Qaeda has become quite active after a period of confusion with these uprisings. In Libya, al-Qaeda sees a real opportunity to come in and to build alliances with local Islamists and different tribal forces, partly because it has a base of support in Libya, and also because a number of the ideologues, the top ideologues of al-Qaeda, are from Libya. So, there's a profound difference, I think, in that respect with what's from, based on what's happening now with the Cold War. So I think, we're in for a long period of instability, largely because no matter what regime comes to power, whether Islamist or democratic, or liberal democratic, these regimes will have to provide economic solutions to the problems of these countries. And I'm not sure that any regime in Egypt, for example, will be able to find these solutions and bring the economic reforms that are necessary to calm the situation down.
Egypt and Tunisia and whoever makes the turn is going to have to then deal with that new reality. But Suzanne, what about the wave itself? I mean, can you put a lid on this thing for another, 30, 40 years? Our caller in Iowa is kind of asking there. Or do you see an immediate, more irresistible quality to what's going on?
Oh, I think anyone who tries to predict what's going to happen next in the Middle East is likely to get themselves into some sort of difficulty, given how unpredictable events have been over the course of the past 6 months.
But, just 2 weeks ago, people were still talking as though this is irresistible. This is happening. And, nobody can stop it.
Well, I think there's a certain momentum which took hold, particularly as you saw the ouster of longstanding autocrats like Ben Ali and Mubarak. That created a kind of euphoria which spread well beyond the borders of those countries, in part because it was being played out on live television all across the Arab world. There's been a lot of talk about Twitter and social media, and obviously those technologies played a huge role in the organization of the protests in Egypt in particular, from what I understand. Mm-hmm. But I think what has been particularly important in bringing this wave in a broader sense across the Middle East and to those of us observing from the West has been the role of Al Jazeera and the simply, extensive television coverage that every individual in the Arab world has had some access to. And that kind of remarkable excitement when you see this positive change can be infectious. What may happen, as I think Professor Haeckel was alluding to, is the potential as things go badly, if successor regimes aren't able to put into place policies that actually provide a better standard of living for the same people who came out to the streets, they're going to begin voicing frustration. And that example, too, is going to be televised across the world. And you may see the same kind of demoralizing effect as a contagion, just as the euphoria has been a contagion.
But even in the period of change, if that's where we still are, you had Arabs saying, again, just a couple of weeks ago, the world has sort of let us be bound up in these politics of oil and sectarian tension in Iran for so long, the presumption that Arabs couldn't get beyond that, the Iranian threat and so on, saying we are more modern, we're more contemporary, we are past that. Recognize us and help us here. Is that not still an option, Suzanne?
Well, the dignity factor is one that's obviously, very, very attractive to a lot of people, this sense that, we've kind of reclaimed our rightful place in the world, particularly for a country like Egypt, which for so long was the center of cultural and political life in the Middle East or in the Arab world, at least. I think that is going to continue to be a very powerful powerful emotion. And yet at the same time, as you see backsliding, as you see, in some cases, demonstrations and democracy movements leading to violence, you may see the kind of frustration and depoliticization that was, very present in Iran for a long time after the revolution. A lot of people who looked and said, we've been there, done that. We've tried this popular uprising thing, and it didn't really work out all that well for us.
Of course, so far, the pro-democracy people have been saying, we're doing this much better than Iran. We're not going into a theocratic kind of dictatorship. We're really going for democracy.
Yeah, I think the distinctions between what's happened in each of these Arab countries and the 1979 revolution in Iran are very, very important.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about new uprisings and old tensions in the Middle East. Dictators versus democracy, Sunni versus Shia, Saudi Arabia versus Iran, and the Arab wave trying to avoid the old traps. We've been joined today from the Brookings Institute by Suzanne Maloney in Washington, from Princeton by Bernard Haeckel, joining us today from New York. We're joined right now as well from Doha, Qatar, by Simon Henderson, fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Just off a plane, he was in Bahrain this morning. Simon Henderson, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
It's great to have you with us. What's your sense of Bahrain? You've just come out of there. Did you have a chance to talk with any of the pro-democracy leadership there about the way this is now suddenly being cast as a Saudi versus Iran or Sunni versus Shia problem in Bahrain? Are they feeling, you know, squeezed back into an old bottle here, Simon?
Well, I had a very brief trip, just a couple of nights, and I was there for other purposes, but mm-hmm. I did speak to some good people who filled me in on what their perspectives, including the government perspective. Mm-hmm. I didn't, in fact, manage to get through to any of the, as you call them, the democracy people. I think, in fact, the democracy label is a slightly wrong label at this stage. I think what they're looking for is a greater measure of human rights in Bahrain, and they haven't got it, and quite frankly, at the moment, they're not getting it. There are many road junctions in Bahrain which have not only police patrol there, but also an army-tracked vehicle and soldiers wearing mm-hmm. ski masks and goggles and pointing machine guns menacingly across the road junction.
A little difficult for the protesters to say anything to you right now, perhaps.
Well, I was in a rush trip, and yeah. I didn't, in fact, seek out the views of the protesters. They actually are being quite well reported by a whole series of people, and I was interested in getting some other perspectives, delving deeper into what was going on in the government. And the relations with the outside world, with Bahrain, and perspectives on the involvement of the Saudis.
Well, isn't the government, I mean, you say it's not a democracy movement any longer, but it certainly has been. I mean, the protesters wanted the Al-Khalifa monarchy to give up a lot of its powers. They wanted the parliament to be reorganized to give more power to the 70% of the population that is Shiite there. Those sound like pro-democratic demands.
Yes, but they're pro-human rights demands. They wanted a much fairer political system. You know, never mind the democracy aspect of it. It's they under the current system, they've been able to vote, but their votes have been fairly meaningless. The Shias, who form the majority in Bahrain, because of the districting, are never able to get a majority in parliament. And parliament itself has very few political powers.
Right.
Everything is concentrated in the hand of the king and in the upper house of parliament, which is a consultative assembly, frankly, appointed by the king.
So what's your most important takeaway from your brief visit to Bahrain just in the last couple of days, Simon, about what's going on there now and the play of powers around this struggle, as you say?
Well, I think the Bahrain government thinks that they've recovered the situation, and they've got a measure of stability. They have got a measure of stability, but it's the stability that is there by an overwhelming display of power by the army. I was driving with a friend last night to dinner at one of the major hotels, and we had to stop at a road junction while a convoy of tanks and armored vehicles drove past. It wasn't a redeployment from point A to point B. It was clearly a patrol to show the power of the army and the power of the government. And frankly, the opposition have gone home to lick their wounds, and decide what to do now.
Do you think that the democracy movement, I'm still going to call it that, that's what they call it, is dead in Bahrain?
No, I don't think it's dead at all, but it's very vulnerable, and the government says that it's going to try to reactivate the dialogue which they had, but frankly, it's a dialogue which wasn't going to give the human rights that the many of the people wanted there, not only, frankly, the Shia community, the majority Shia community, but also the Sunnis as well. And for the moment, everything has been cast in this dreadful divide of the Shiites versus Sunnis, and the major enemy is depicted as being Iran. In fact, for the moment, as far as I can make out, and this is what people were telling me, it's still very a domestic political problem, but it's ripe for exploitation by Iran, and frankly, unless they manage to think of some better political ideas to do, it's going to be exploited by Iran. The Shias of Bahrain are frustrated with their predicament. They're angry with the force that the government used to put down what they regarded as their peaceful demonstrations.
Mm-hmm.
And they are outraged that, you know, not only... well, they didn't have democracy before, but not only is democracy not in prospect, but their human rights of what they regard as their human rights, and frankly, what you and I would regard as their human rights, freedom of expression, freedom of assembly, and things like this, are very curtailed.
I guess so, with troops in face masks and with assault rifles at the intersections there. Simon Henderson, just out of Bahrain this morning, author of After King Abdullah. Thank you very much for joining us, Simon.
Thank you.
Let's go to Laura in Nashville, Tennessee. Laura, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thanks. Hi, Tom and the other guests. I totally agree with the perspective that, but even more so, that this is a human rights issue, the right of life, which in self-governance,
mm-hmm.
which is supported by either a faith-based or moral perspective that all human beings are entitled to this, or an evolutionary perspective by the means of self-governance through evolution, people have risen to the top. And to me, this is the perspective, and never should the choice be made to support a certain ideal out of fear, because... we don't have to.
So should the United States be supporting the democracy movement in Bahrain now when our old ally, the monarchy, Saudi Arabia, is rolled in itself to help crush it?
That does not matter, because to me, poor choices that we've made as peoples or governments in the past, we don't have to continue to make. We should always support the ideals of basic human rights to self-governance, because no matter what perspective we're looking at it from, whether it's, like I said, scientifically
mm-hmm.
or morally.
Mm-hmm. Laura, we've got it. We've got it loud and clear. And yet, Suzanne Maloney, you hear Simon Henderson there talking about the old Sunni-Shia conflict lines and the old Iran threat being sort of framed right around Bahrain again.
Well, you know, I think clearly there is, you know, the sense that the Saudis are seeing this very much in terms of regional security, in terms of their own security, and are completely unwilling to, you know, sort of liberalize their views of Bahrain itself. I think the deeply unfortunate consequence of what we're seeing play out in Bahrain is that it enables the Iranians in intensely hypocritical fashion, as Professor Haeckel said
mm-hmm.
earlier,
mm-hmm.
to portray themselves as the defenders of human rights around the region, when in fact, of course, they've done a very effective job of repressing their own pro-democracy movement. And yet, because they are the ones speaking out on behalf of the Shia protesters in Bahrain, they then can, I think, gain some traction around the region both by appearing to be supporters of true democracy and also in terms of painting the United States as an enemy of democracy. They sow a lot of skepticism and doubt about the real intentions of Washington, which is, you know, deeply problematic for us over the long term. So, you know, I don't think it's strategically wise what we're seeing play out in Bahrain, and I don't think it, you know, it really holds up to a moral inspection, as the caller said. You know, the difficulty for the administration is simply in trying to negotiate and try to impress upon the Saudis. And as has been said several times on the programs already, mm-hmm. that, you know, our influence with the Saudis at this stage is at a very low ebb.
Bernard Haykel, the power trend has been widely perceived to be Iran gaining in recent years. This is exactly from the kind of positioning that Suzanne's describing there. Could it be a strategic Saudi error to be coming down with actual troops on the ground in Bahrain here? Might that not just feed Iran's influence that it may not at all deserve, given its own miserable democratic and humanitarian track record?
I mean, certainly, you know, that Iran could take advantage of the situation. But I think that the Saudis, you know, feel more comfortable thinking of the problem of Bahrain as a sectarian problem or as a problem with Iran rather than as a human rights issue, because then they would have to face a number of other questions about themselves and the way their own people's
their own
people
Shiite
are treated,
and so, mm-hmm.
for instance, amongst others. Mm-hmm. You know, the regimes of this region, leaving aside, you know, Egypt and Tunisia, where you haven't had real revolutions yet because the army in both country in both countries are still in control. But these other countries, you know, whether it's Syria or Yemen or Saudi or Libya, you know, these countries are very tenacious in their hold on power and will not let go easily, and will use all kinds of means at their disposal to remain in power. And whilst, you know, Al Jazeera can broadcast images all over the world and galvanize people to rebel in this wave-like fashion, it's interesting to see that Jazeera, for instance, on Bahrain and on Saudi Arabia, has been very, very mute. And, you know, when this wave came very close to Qatar...
Which sponsors Al Jazeera, so it's in their neighborhood now. Mm-hmm.
That's right. Once it got to their neighborhood, they stopped covering it as intensely or as accurately and in this inflammatory way, which is what they were doing in Tunisia, Egypt, and Libya, and continue to do. So you know, I having ideals and pushing for ideals is a good thing. I think there are, though, realities on the ground in the sense that these regimes are going to hold on to power with all the means at their disposal. And, you know, if Saudi Arabia, for instance, were to topple or was to have real problems and the oil would stop flowing, you know, the world would go into a depression and we would have to start paying $4, $5, $10 a gallon. And I don't know whether people in the United States would be willing to do that.
Of course, many have said whoever's in power is going to keep pumping, and you seem to have just outlined exactly the rationale that the whole wave was celebrating, defying in recent weeks, the rationale of decades that Arabs stood up and said, no, thank you, Professor Haykel, we're finished with that. Don't keep us in that trap.
And I agree, with them. But, you know, the short-term to medium-term disruptions could be catastrophic to the world. I mean, yes, eventually whatever regime takes over in Saudi Arabia in a year, 2 years, or 3 years down the road will end up selling the oil. Every regime sells oil there, including Iran. But in the short term, the consequences could be really, really catastrophic. And I'm sure President Obama is thinking about this. You know, he has to come up for re-election in a very short time, and having a depression in this country is not going to help him win an election.
Let's go to Fairfax City, Virginia, and Adil. Adil, you're on the air.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. I have a comment here. Unless elections are held in Bahrain, we will never know what democracy brings to this tiny island. The Saudi incursion in Bahrain is intended to frame the pro-democracy movement in a sectarian way.
Mm-hmm.
They want to rally the Sunnis around them because democracy is a real threat to them, more than Iran itself.
More than Iran, but Iran cracked down on its own democracy. I mean, if you're in the democratic camp, where do you look here for hope, Adil?
But look what happened in Egypt. Who brought Mubarak's regime down? It's the Sunnis, not Iran. And Mubarak had kept raising the Shia threat of Iran and Hezbollah several times. But what brought the regime down is the Sunnis, the wrongdoings that Mubarak himself have done to his own people.
But, of course, our time is short. I thank you, Adil. Of course, Egypt has that big and comfortable Sunni majority. Is that just out of reach, Suzanne Maloney, for countries deeper into the Arab heartland here, countries where you have the Shia, Sunni, you know, division of populations? Is that it? Is it evaporating before our eyes, the dream that was seemed so alive a couple of weeks ago?
No, I think we have to speak specifically about different countries, mm-hmm. recognizing mm-hmm. that there are some commonalities between what's happening, some linkages among what's happening in different countries, but very different nuances and very different contexts. Bahrain has nothing like the population of Egypt in terms of size and demography, and the sectarian breakdown makes it a very different situation, as does its proximity and financial dependence on the Saudi monarchy. And so, while there are some similarities in the movement, it was inevitable that it would play out in very different fashion. I think the challenge is going to be trying to manage different crises that are interlinked for everyone, both Washington and the governments in the region.
Well, I have a feeling none of this is over. As the bombs come down in Libya, that not settled, though the world's attention drawn there by that intervention. And here, still, as you've helped us see more clearly, in the Gulf and heart of the Middle East, a lot of tension still to play out. Very grateful for your insights today. Suzanne Maloney of the Brookings Institute, author of Iran's Long Reach. Suzanne, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
And Bernard Haykel at Princeton, professor there of Near East Studies. Professor Haykel, thank you for your time and thoughts.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thank you for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.